You're listening to the Tupten Children Podcast.
And really have a sense of joy and gratitude for our opportunity to be here, to hear the Dharma, to take the Dharma into our hearts. A sense of the incredible dependent arising that whereby so many different things have to come together for each of us to be here this evening, to be able to listen to the teachings. Yet somehow all those causes and conditions came together. And here we are. And so let's really take the most of the situation and have a far-reaching perspective that wants to use this opportunity for the benefit of self and others. Specifically by actualizing the path to full awakening. So let's make that our intention for being here. So I found this note, or rather, page in my box. Yeah. It's question 2, 10, and 12. Okay. I don't know what happened to the other intermediate numbers, but there's some questions from the quizzes that you were doing while I was in India. Okay, so we'll go through these quickly. So what is the object apprehended by the wisdom realizing emptiness? And what is the apprehended object of ignorance? Now think about that for a while, you should know it. What's the object apprehended by the wisdom realizing emptiness? Emptiness. It's not a turkey. Okay, it's emptiness. What's the object apprehended by ignorance? Yeah. It's this weird way of saying it. We can say inherent existence, but it's probably more correct to say that consciousness is erroneous with respect to its apprehended object because it apprehends it as inherently existent. But the meaning is the same. But the correct way to say it is that latter way, because to be an object, something has to be existent. So you can't really say an inherently existent turkey is object of the apprehended object, because such a turkey doesn't exist. Okay. And then could I speak about some different terms and how they relate to that question. So the terms apprehend versus grasp. So in Tibetan, it's the same word, zin, okay, which means actually to hold. So sometimes it's translated as apprehend, sometimes as grasp. And I do my best to kind of differentiate them using apprehend when it's a reliable cognizer, using grasp when it's not. However, it doesn't have to be always translated like that. You could say something, you know, this mind apprehends inherent existence. I think it's clearer to say it grasps inherent existence, but it would also be okay to say it apprehends inherent existence, but it's an erroneous consciousness. Okay. And then somebody took something from insight into empty. emptiness. Whoever wrote this, did you actually find this sentence in Insight? Okay, so it says, the self that does not exist is the focal object for both the true grasping mind and the wisdom realizing selflessness. So what this means, I don't know if focal object is the exact right word. It's that if you talk about object and aspect, then, you know, it's the same object, except, you know, like the mere eye is the object. But the wisdom realizing emptiness sees that eye as empty, and ignorance sees it as inherently existent. You could also say that the eye, the mere eye, is the base. Yeah, so it's the base upon which one mind sees it as empty, one mind sees it as truly existent. Okay? And then there's another sentence from Insight into Emptiness. According to the Prasangikas, to exist means to exist conventionally, to exist nominally, and to exist as mere imputation. Is there any other kind of existence besides that existence? No. Okay. So to exist means to exist conventionally. Why can't things exist ultimately?
Yeah.
Well, how about one of them?
It would be permanent.
Yeah, it would be permanent. Okay. It would be findable under analysis. Okay. And then, explain the meaning of phenomena are ultimately false and conventionally existent. So is this statement correct? Yes. Okay, so why are phenomena ultimately false?
Is there ultimate nature? Is there ultimate nature?
Yeah, but what does false mean?
They don't exist
as they appear.
They don't exist the way they appear. Okay? So on the ultimate level, they don't exist the way they appear. They appear, how do they appear? Truly existence, how do they exist?
Empty. This is where we have a hard time with that.
Okay.
It doesn't appear that way to an Arya.
Yeah, it does. An Arya in post-meditation, things still appear truly existent. In meditative equipoise, they don't see truly existent objects at all.
That's why I had to go into this thing, exist. Because exist, we've already defined now as conventional existence.
Yeah.
It's the only existence there is.
Right. But do you say that the turkey appears empty to the Arya's meditative equipoise?
They wouldn't see
the only thing that appears to the Arya's meditative equipoise is emptiness. So it's not that the turkey appears, you have the turkey and it appears empty. Yeah,
okay.
Only emptiness appears. Okay, so things are ultimately false, okay, because they don't exist the way they appear, to an ordinary being and to an Arya who is in post-meditation time. Okay, emptiness exists the way it appears. Yeah. Now you might say, but what about to a conceptual understanding of an inference? You know, so does emptiness exist as it appears there? No. However, when we say emptiness exists as it appears, the meaning is as it appears to the primary consciousness that's cognizing it. which is the Arya's meditative equipoise on emptiness. Okay? And it has to relate to the primary mind that's cognizing it. Okay. So things are ultimately false. We got that. And conventionally existent. Right? If they were ultimately true, then things would be truly existent. Then we would really be in a stew.
I think where I have trouble is that I have so much training myself to think about ultimate truth and conventional truth, and to say something exists as it appears, it's a truth. It doesn't exist as it appears, it's a conventional truth. And that's how I frame everything in my mind. And then when we get to this thing of when they take it out of when they put it into the language of is it conventionally existent or ultimately existent, then the whole thing of existing as it appears, the way it's looking to be looked at morphs.
Yeah. The thing is that the words ultimate and conventional mean different things in different phrases. That's what the confusing thing is. Okay? Okay, because, for example, in ultimate truth, ultimate means it exists the way it appears. Yeah. In ultimately existent, it means things are findable under analysis. Okay. Yeah. It's very confusing the way they use the words until you figure out that conventional and ultimate mean different things in different expressions. Okay. Clear? Okay. Then, Okay, so we did that. And then what is a conventional reliable cognizer and what does it apprehend? So a conventional reliable cognizer is a mind, according to Prasangika, that is able to apprehend what exists, conventionally. And remember, everything exists conventionally, nothing exists ultimately. So even though emptiness is an ultimate truth, it exists conventionally. This conventional existence means existence. Okay? So a reliable cognizer, for the prasangikas, it apprehends the object in a conventionally non-deceptive way, in the sense that it can recognize a table as a table and a chair as a chair. But that mind is still mistaken. It's not erroneous, but it's mistaken. Why?
It's still appearing on paper, respect to its appearing.
Yeah, because it's still, true existence still appears to it. So it's mistaken. It's not erroneous because it can recognize the object as it is. Yeah. If you see a chair as a turkey, what's that? It's a wrong consciousness. That's not a reliable cognizer. Okay? We done with that? Sorry.
Well, what do you think about the answer that I thought was stated in the class?
What was that?
Things that function conventionally was the answer that I had in my notes. And I just
function conventionally is what? The meaning of what?
This was, what does it apprehend? The answer I have in my notes.
Things that the function, well, does a conventional, reliable cognizer apprehend the existence of emptiness?
No.
What mind apprehends the existence of emptiness then? Is the existence of emptiness an ultimate truth or a conventional truth? The existence of emptiness is a conventional truth. It's apprehended Okay, emptiness is different from the existence of emptiness. Yeah? So the existence of emptiness is a conventional truth. Okay, emptiness is an ultimate truth. Okay, emptiness is apprehended by the meditative equipoise on emptiness. The existence of emptiness is apprehended by a conventional valid cognizer, a conventional reliable cognizer. Okay? Okay, yeah. When you go over it enough, then it begins to make sense. Yeah. Yeah, because it makes us really think, you know, and be much clearer in our minds. Yeah. It just seems complicated. Okay, so let's go back to, we're on chapter 2 of Precious Garland. So chapter 2 is the interwoven, because it starts out, he started out talking about the way to attain highest good, meaning liberation and awakening, and now he's going back to how to attain higher rebirth, and then later in the chapter he'll go back again to how to attain the highest good. So it's interwoven, you know, in that way. So we're on a section where he's talking about now the causes and effects of higher rebirth. So in verse 124, just to do a little bit of reviewing, when this dharma, meaning emptiness, is not understood, eye grasping continues. Due to that, one engages in constructive and destructive karma, and from that comes fortunate and unfortunate rebirths. So, you know, emphasizing ignorance is the root of samsara. From it come the afflictions, from that come the virtuous and non-virtuous karma that produce rebirth in samsara. Okay? The 125, therefore, as long as you have not understood this dharma, here this dharma again means emptiness, this dharma that destroys the eye-grasping, devote yourself to the dharma of generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude. So as long as we haven't had direct realization of emptiness, yeah, and even after we've had it, still we need to practice the method side of the path. And so here the method side of the path, he's outlining the first three of the six perfections, generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude. So you can also see it as when emptiness just seems way above your head and you can't grok it, go back to generosity and ethical conduct and fortitude and practice those and accumulate merit. And then he says, so I'm still reviewing here. So King, if you undertake deeds that begin with dharma, have dharma in the middle and dharma at the end, you will not be harmed in this world or the next. Through dharma, you will attain fame and pleasure. You have no fear now or at death. And in the next world, you will have great joy. So always devote yourself to the dharma. So here the dharma means in more general the Buddha's teachings. But this is, I think these verses are quite beautiful, you know? Like, you know, the dharma, a dharma perspective at the beginning, middle, and end of whatever you're doing, then you're not going to receive harm in this life or in future lives. What you're doing is good. You don't have any fear. You don't have any regret. You aren't mired in self-doubt and confusion. So it's good, you know, if we can discern just even, you know, the conventional teachings like he was saying, and generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude, and practice those. Boy, it makes the mind so much more peaceful in our life. Okay, and then he talks about some benefits, fame and pleasure, just what we want, huh? Anybody want fame and pleasure? Yes! Come on, be honest. Yeah? But if you think about it, do you really want fame and pleasure? I mean, our garbage mind wants fame and pleasure, but are those things really going to be conducive for our Dharma practice? Yeah. If you're practicing as a bodhisattva, the fame can be useful. Pleasure's not so bad if it keeps you healthy and so on. But to the mind of attachment, those two are like poison, aren't they? Okay, so he also, in these two verses, he talks of five benefits, so I'll just review those two. So first, by acting with integrity and kindness, you'll have a good reputation. So that works in this life. Due to not acting in destructive ways, you won't be overwhelmed with remorse and regret and will have a happy mind. That's true. By practicing nonviolence in this life, you will be free of fear, and neither human beings nor spirits will have reason to harm you. For at the time of death, you will die peacefully, free from fear of an unfortunate rebirth. And five, in this life and in future lives, your happiness will continue to expand. So therefore, always maintain a virtuous attitude at the beginning, middle, and end of what you're doing. Okay, so then 128 is where we stopped. So 128 says, Dharma is the highest policy. Dharma pleases the world. And if the world is pleased, you will not be deceived here or hereafter. Okay? So he's talking to a king. You know, Dharma is the highest policy. He's also talking to us. Okay? But he's saying that between the way of Dharma and the way of the world, always choose the Dharma way. Yeah, because the Dharma will bring benefit to self, it brings benefit to others. And if you're a king or if you're in any kind of leadership position whatsoever, doing things in a Dharma way, especially with integrity and ethics and kindness, then you know, it's going to bring good to whatever project you're doing. And you can see this, you know, if you're in a leadership position and you're bossy and domineering and you like to put people down and humiliate them and, you know, do all sorts of things so you get their way or get your way or make them afraid of you, thinking that they're confusing fear with respect. You know? So if you're in a leadership position and act like that, are your projects going to be successful? You know, difficult, isn't it? Yeah. You might force people to do a bunch of things, but in the end, they're gonna quit, they're gonna revolt, they're gonna do something. Whereas if you're in a leadership position and you treat people respectfully, and so on, then, you know, those people will be good followers. And to be a good leader, you need good followers. Yeah, people think leaders are like independent entities. Yeah, they aren't. You can't be a leader unless there's followers. And you can't be a good leader and get things accomplished unless there's good followers. Yeah. If there's not good followers, then the leader's stuck and can't do anything. And if the leader isn't wise, then the followers aren't going to follow. And, you know, everything turns out messy. Okay, we can also see here, because he's really talking to the king as a leader, and we all have leadership responsibilities in some areas of our life. Yeah, so it really pertains to all of us. That, you know, when we're the person that people are looking to, our behavior, our tone really sets the whole atmosphere, the whole energy for the entire group. And you can see this in offices when they do analysis of office structures, you know, that if the, you know, if the people on lower levels are arguing, chances are the people on the higher levels are arguing too. Okay. When we were in Singapore, we ran into a situation like that, really quite unfortunate. Some people were telling us about something, and the, you know, the followers were arguing. And why were the followers arguing? Because the leaders weren't getting along. Yeah, so it really makes a difference with everybody. So, you know, if the leaders treat people respectfully, then the followers tend to do also. Not always, but they tend to. Whereas if the leader's behavior is really like denigrating people, then the followers, there's going to be a lot of harsh speech and lying and backbiting and gossip and all of that going on. Yeah. When we look at our own work experience, or even living in Dharma centers, you know, you can see that kind of mechanism happening. Okay, so also by acting in accordance with the Dharma, then the leaders are honest and fair and impartial. And then, of course, you know, they're concerned with everybody in the group. So then the people in the group feel good about what's happening, and they're supportive, and they're more harmonious amongst each other. Okay, so it's in this way that Dharma becomes the highest policy. Makes sense, doesn't it? Okay, then 129, but a policy that proceeds without Dharma will not please the world. And if the world is not pleased, you will not be happy here or hereafter. So, you know, any kind of policy that isn't supported by Dharma, in other words, you know, people are lying and cheating and having some kind of dirty competition with each other and talking behind each other's back and putting each other down and complaining and everything like that. Okay, so a policy, if that's the kind of mood in the organization, then it doesn't please the world, it doesn't please the people who are involved. And if the world is not pleased, you, as the leader, will not be happy here or hereafter. So you won't be happy here because you're working with a bunch of people who are unhappy, and you won't be happy in the hereafter, in the future lives, because you yourself have been acting in a very harmful way towards other people, and that karma comes back on you. And now he's getting into, in 130, kind of different political theories. I find this quite interesting. Okay, so Nagarjuna says, a useless political theory is one that intends to deceive others. It is harsh and a path to bad rebirths. How could the unwise make such a theory useful? Since that deception will just deceive oneself for many thousands of rebirths, how could one intent on deceiving others be a true statesman at all? Okay, so apparently in ancient India, there were, and nowadays too, you know, people write these political treatises talking about how to govern and how to rule and how to do things. And so some of them, these treatises are quite pernicious and have like all sorts of wrong ideas in them. I heard, you know, what is it, Mein Kampf is going to be available in Germany now because the patent ran out on it or something, and then something, so now people can read it. But books like that, or, you know, probably Mao's Little Red Book, lots of these kinds of things, you know, the way they talk about governing, it teaches people harmful values and harmful actions. And then when people follow these treatises, the countries the governed areas wind up in a mess. Okay, so advocating violent and malicious policies that disturb the harmony in society, create ill will in society, and they just make a mess of everybody because the leaders aren't behaving properly, then all the citizens aren't. So if the leaders are cheating and stealing and there's a lot of corruption, then people in society, you know, they do the same thing. I think this is one of India's biggest problems, that, you know, Modi was, he ran on the basis of trying to clean this up. But of course, he's now, from what we hear, following other wrong theories of governance and really being very, having a very kind of Hindu nationalism, which is completely gonna make a mess of India. Yeah, so many people are getting disillusioned with him because of this. We heard this from many of the Indians we spoke with. And you can see, you know, if you don't treat all the citizens in the place in some kind of equal way, you know, one group's going to be happy, but all the other people are going to be miserable, and they're going to let you know that they're miserable. Okay? So it seems like in some of these ancient treatises, some of them encouraged animal sacrifice. So the leaders were supposed to do animal sacrifice on the, you know, for the benefit of the country. Or other treatises said that when Brahmins are destitute, it's okay for them to steal. That sounds really smart, doesn't it? Yeah, the highest caste, they can steal, everybody else can't. Okay, in modern times, we too have witnessed all sorts of pernicious political philosophies, haven't we? You know, from Nazism, communism, you know, ISIS philosophy right now. I mean, that one's really awful, isn't it, for the people that are living under it. You know, all these different groups have their own philosophy. You know, the more we can do terrorist activities, the more we're successful. How is that successful? What does success mean in the minds of those people? What are they looking for? Yeah? And so you see it's bringing unhappiness this life. It's creating horrible karma for people in future lives. You know, when I think of these terrorists that kill people and then, blow themselves up, like in Paris, they went and killed a bunch of people and then blew themselves up. I mean, you create massive negative karma and then you die. And you're dying with a mind of hatred, having all this fresh negative karma on your mind. What kind of rebirth are you going to have? You know? And then to think that there's whole philosophies that advocate that as something good, you die as a martyr and you have a good rebirth in heaven. You know, what Monargatuna talks about, you know, when he says here, since that deception will just deceive oneself for many thousands of rebirths. Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. One's deceiving oneself. Yeah. So how can you be a real statesman, you know, a real person who's caring for others, if you have those kind of bad beliefs? No, it doesn't work. And yet, it's so remarkable, isn't it? Because we read in the newspapers, like every day, there's reports of different people being caught for corruption of some sort or another. And yet, people keep doing the same corrupt actions, thinking that they won't get caught. Yeah? It's kind of amazing, isn't it? Now, when we look at other people's experience and see how, you know, they do these things, and then it falls apart for them, and then somehow we think, well, we can do it, and it won't fall apart for us. That is like the opposite of clear thinking, isn't it? Yeah? So, unfortunately, we have a lot of that in the world. Okay? So, some of these people who make these kind of political treatises, some of them directly harm other people, some harm people's possessions, some harm their bodies, some harm their minds. But none of them are good methods that are based on wisdom that bring happiness to people now and happiness in the future. Yeah. And so, especially somebody in a leadership position, if you involve the followers in non-virtue, even though you think you're working for their benefit, and you follow some kind of political theory that says what you're doing is good, actually, if you're leading them in the path of non-virtue, you're deceiving others and deceiving yourself. Yeah? So you look, and so many, you know, so many politicians, when they take power, I've been doing some reading about Indonesia recently because a friend of mine wrote a book about it. She gave it to me when I was in Singapore. And, you know, Suharto, when he came to power, he killed about 500,000 people that were supposedly communist. The idea being to make the country safer. Well, how are you really going to make the country safer by killing 500,000 people? And what kind of karma are you creating in doing that? Yeah. And yet you find, I mean, one country after the other, you know, one country after the other, this keeps on occurring, doesn't it? I read a very interesting quote. The Singaporeans will appreciate this one. Well, maybe they won't. Because Suharto, I mean the country, India, Indonesia was dirt poor when he took over. And he, you know, he and his family did all these kind of corrupt business practices with different people, with different business people. The businesses flourished. It helped bring a lot of money into Indonesia. It raised the living standard, even though the whole thing was based on corruption because the business people were giving Suharto and his family money, and then they were guaranteeing, giving them licenses and protecting their goods, and, you know, this whole kind of system that they have, which apparently was how most of Southeast Asia was functioning after the war. But, you know, he did that, and then he killed the 500,000 people. But also, even though he was forced to resign in 1998, the country economically was in much better position than it had been when he came. So Lee Kuan Yew, in talking about this, I wish I had the book in front of me where I could give you the exact quote, but it was something to the effect of, well, he was corrupt about, you know, a few million dollars, or he was corrupt about a few things, but he brought so much benefit to the country in the end that what's that little bit of corruption, you know? Which I thought was a priceless quote from somebody who himself was a leader, you know? You say, well, yeah, a little bit of corruption, if it's for the good of the people at the end, it doesn't matter. Gulp. Okay.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Somebody that works on the buildings around here, mm-hmm. He told me recently, I don't think our system here could work necessarily, that anyone could get anything done his view now on things. That's so.
Yeah, people are quite cynical now. But you see the whole Halliburton thing that happened with our government. I mean, I'm sure there's all sorts of stuff going on.
It's constant stuff like that in the government.
Yeah. Okay, so Kazumuche says here, you know, of course, you know, how can you be a real statesman if you're acting, have that kind of behavior? And then he says, this is beautiful the way he puts it, he says, it is simple, really. Those actions are non-virtuous. Whatever way you look at it, whether you consider the ripening result, the environmental result, the causally concordant results, similar to the experience or to the behavior, or even the results in this life, suffering comes from these actions. It's true. And yet, we keep doing them. Okay, so non-harmfulness, non-violence are basic tenets of Buddhism, and they're things that it's really important for us to adhere to. And they're things that we promised to adhere to when we took refuge. So we should try and keep this as much as we can. And even though things in the near term, the short term may not turn out so well because we're refusing to be corrupt, in the long term, things work out better, you know. And you can at least go to bed with a clear conscience, not worrying about, you know, getting arrested and prosecuted and so on. Okay. So then he also says, the Buddha's and Bodhisattva's heartfelt wish is for sentient beings to be happy and be free of suffering. So anybody who acts opposite to this is acting opposite to the wishes of the Buddha's and Bodhisattva's. And so clearly no good is going to come from that. Yeah. There's a statement, I can't remember where it is in here, but he quotes the Buddha as saying at one point, you know, if you harm others, you're not my disciple. Yeah, that's pretty strong, isn't it? So maybe we go back and forth between being the Buddha's disciple or not being the Buddha's disciple. But it kind of, I remember reading that. Gee, you know, it kind of woke me up. Okay, then 132. This is an interesting verse. If you wish to make your foes unhappy, do away with your faults and enhance your good qualities. That way you will gain great benefit and your enemies will also be displeased. Now that sounds quite strange, doesn't it? Yeah, if you want to make your foes unhappy, then do away with your faults and enhance your good qualities. Now why would that make your foes unhappy?
Because it will make you happy.
Yeah, because it makes you happy. And it makes your projects and your works more successful because, you know, they are no longer hindered by your own faults. So, and also, when someone's doing great harm and we have the ability to stop them, if we generate a great, you know, a very virtuous motivation and intercede, this benefits us, but it also displeases our enemies. Okay, so generating some kind of wisdom that can intercede and bad things, yeah. And then, of course, you know, the more we improve our own good qualities and our own projects work better and so on, then our enemies are going to be really unhappy. So what does that do if you try and do away with your faults, but your motivation is to make your enemy unhappy? Is that virtue or not virtue?
Or is it even successful?
What?
Why are you even successful then?
Yeah. Okay, then next verse, 133. Be generous, speak gently, be beneficent, act with the same intention that you wish from others. Through these ways of acting, bring together the world and also sustain the Dharma. Okay, so here again he's talking to the king as a leader, but we are also leaders in various areas of our life. And so here he's actually talking about the four means of attracting others, also called the four ways of gathering disciples. Okay? So these are our four ways to care for others, by influencing them to go in a good direction and by helping to ripen their mind streams. Okay? And so to guide others in the way of the Dharma, yeah, first, we're generous. The first line says, be generous. Okay, so we're generous. We give people gifts. And so that attract, you know, people are attracted to people who are generous, aren't they? Yeah. If we also practice the generosity of fearlessness by protecting them when they're in danger, or we practice the generosity of love by offering emotional support and counseling. You know, all those forms of generosity make people attracted to us. So here the idea is you're not making people attracted to you because you want a good motivation for the reasons of the eight worldly dharmas, okay? It's not with that motivation. You may be seeking a good reputation, but it's because with a good reputation, then you have the opportunity to benefit a lot of people. I mean, you look at His Holiness Dalai Lama, he has a great reputation. That's why he can benefit so many people. I mean, even people who aren't Buddhists, because when he speaks, people listen. Yeah. So I don't think he had it, the eight worldly concerns is the motivation for having a good reputation. But, you know, if you're sincerely generous from your heart, then people are attracted to you. If you're falsely generous from your heart, I think people eventually pick up on it. Yeah, because they notice, they notice that we only give them something before we ask them to do something for us and ask them for a favor. Yeah. So they can pick up on that pretty quickly. Okay, then the second thing here, it says, so be generous, speak gently. So it means speak in a pleasant way. So about what? Yeah, not about what the neighbors are doing, yeah, but about the Dharma. So instructing them in the causes for higher rebirth and the highest good. Yeah. So be generous, speak gently, be beneficent. Okay? So here being beneficent means encouraging others to practice the Dharma that you've taught them. So it's not just that you, teach them the Dharma and say, okay, ciao, bye, good luck. You hang around and you encourage them and you guide them and you help them really take the Dharma into their hearts and to practice in the correct way. Okay? And then act with the same intention that we wish from others. What that means is practice what you preach. Yeah, to put it simply. Or they call it acting, the polite term is acting in accordance with the instructions that you give others. But it means practicing what we preach. And again, you know, it's kind of clear. If we don't practice what we instruct others to do, then they're not going to trust us and they're not going to trust the instructions that we've given them. They probably won't follow them. And so it's kind of waste. It's a waste of energy. Yeah. This becomes difficult when you're teaching a lot of things that you understand intellectually, but you haven't gotten around to really practicing them yourself, or you find them difficult to practice yourself. Yeah, so you want to be able to instruct people on these. Yeah, and you want to be able to be transparent, but you also don't feel so good about what people are seeing when, you know, when they see our own actions, because we're talking about, you know, don't gossip, and then we gossip. So, you know, it's really a reminder to ourselves to, yeah, to don't not shoot ourselves in the foot, and, you know, try as best as we can to live, and, you know, according to what we're instructing other people. And when we make mistakes, to at least admit them, instead of burying them under and something and blaming them on somebody else. I'm not perfect. The teaching's good, and I taught you the right thing, but I'm not perfect. So, yeah, don't lose faith in the teaching because of that. Okay, then some more good instructions for kings and people in leadership positions. 134 and 135. A single truth uttered by kings makes their subjects have firm trust in them. Likewise, one falsehood on their part is the best way to lose that trust. To speak the truth is to speak in a manner that is not deceptive. It is not what is in fact distorted by an intention. Okay, a statement is true by being of benefit to others. The other kind of statement is false since it is not beneficial. So here there's a definition of lying, okay, that we'll get into. Okay, so these two verses are about training in truth and telling the truth. So speaking falsely arises from a mind that wants to deceive others, to trick them so that we get some kind of benefit and they get some kind of inconvenience or harm. If we speak falsely, you know, people, and we lie, people eventually figure it out. Yeah, when you think in your own life of some of the lies that you've told, have you been able to, like, carry on that lie for a long period of time? Or, you know, eventually do people begin questioning what you've told them? And we can see also when other people have lied to us, what happens when you feel like, yeah, that doesn't sound like what you told me last time. And so trust, you know, which is such an important component of human relations. Trust depends a lot on telling the truth. And I think it's very, here when he says, a single truth uttered by kings make their subjects have firm trust in them. So, you know, if you really tell the truth as it is, you know, people trust you. Likewise, one falsehood on their part is the best way to lose that trust. So in the same way, you know, you may be cultivating a lot of trust with different people, and then you lie to them one time, and that trust is out the window, isn't it? Yeah. And I think this happens a lot in marriages. People, you know, start off telling the truth, and then, you know, you do something you don't want your spouse to know about so much, so you kind of, you don't lie, but for their benefit, you lie. That's what it boils down to. Yeah. And, you know, and it destroys trust. And it always brings me back to one situation I remember so clearly. There was somebody that I really trusted very much, and And he told a lie to me about something that he didn't need to lie to me about at all. If he had told the truth, it would have been completely fine, you know. But he lied because he wanted me to do something. If he had told me the truth, I would have helped anyway, you know. But the fact that he lied, it really, in my mind, it's like, you know, it destroyed the trust in a very big way. Yeah. So especially in a leadership position, if you're deceiving people and lying to them, it makes them lose that trust. This book I was reading about Indonesia, so interesting, when it was talking about, I was telling you, these businessmen who were making deals with Suharto and with the generals and the military. One of them really, you know, he was renowned as somebody with integrity, because if he said he was going to do something, he did it. Yeah, and he treated people fairly. He treated people respectfully. He did what he said he was going to do. He didn't try to deceive or cheat the other business partners. But the whole way the business was structured, based on corruption with people in the power, was rotten. But that businessman himself saw himself as an ethical person. And the other people around him saw him as an ethical person. Because he didn't cheat in his business dealings. Although he, you know, gave money, large amounts of money to the government and the private parties and got all this illegal benefit. It's so interesting. You know, I found that fascinating, reading the book, how, you know, in some people's mind, okay, well, the whole system, we know everybody's corrupt. Yeah, we accept everybody's corrupt. That's just the way things are done here. But this person's really ethical within that corrupt, within being corrupt. Yeah, that was like the Lee Kuan Yew quote, you know, well, he cheated some people out of this, but it was only a little bit compared to all the benefit that he did. I find that quite interesting. Yeah. Do you?
Isn't there a term for that? Honor amongst thieves or something like that?
Yeah, honor amongst thieves. Yeah, yeah, that is true. And actually, you know, the guys we write to who are in prison, they have a very strong ethical code about how you're supposed to act, and, you know. But it's a partial ethical code. Yeah, you don't lie to these people. The other people, it's okay. Yeah. Very interesting. You know, how human beings think is really fascinating. Okay, so then the 135... when he says, to speak the truth is to speak in a manner that is not deceptive. It is not what is in fact distorted by an intention. A statement is true by being of benefit to others. The other kind of statement is false since it is not beneficial. So, okay. So in addition to kind of saying that, you know, little white lies also count as lying, and, you know, because we're trying to deceive somebody to get some benefit for ourselves. Actually, Kinzer Rinpoche told this really cute story here about a young monk. Well, he said a young boy, but I think it must have been a young monk, who thought that telling the truth was foolish, because when he told his teacher the truth about what he had been doing, his teacher was upset with him because he was playing and not studying. But when he lied, then his teacher was very happy with him. So he thought, you know, lying was much better than telling the truth. And so a lot of people think this. Yeah, we can get some benefit from lying, but, you know, in the end, it usually... it breaks down, it doesn't work. Okay, when you speak only the truth, engage in a path of truth, and act always on the basis of truth, here's the sentence I was referring to before, then even if temporarily things may not go very well or you may have problems, in the long term you will get a true result, because from truth comes truth. Yeah? So speaking the truth means speaking in a non-deceptive way, okay? So not trying to make somebody believe something that you know is incorrect, okay? But speaking truthfully also has another element. It has to be beneficial. Okay? So speaking the truth involves not only saying what's factually true, yeah, but also something that's not distorted by our bad intention. So it has to be something that we're saying with a good intention. We may speak what is factually true, but if it's said with the intention to harm, it's not correct speech. Because I remember sometimes when we've discussed lying before, you know, the question comes up, well, you know, what about lying, the lies of omission, you know, shouldn't I just tell the whole truth and get it all out there even though it's going to create chaos? Yeah, well, Nagarjuna's answer is no. You know, it has to be something that's said with the intention to benefit. Okay, and so, you know, and this comes often, you know, when they're talking about how the Buddha teaches different things to different people. And so to some people, because of their mental disposition, he says that there's a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Or to some people, he'll tell them there's an inherently existent self. So people say, isn't the Buddha lying? He knows those things aren't true. Those kind of selves exist. Isn't he lying when he says this? Yeah. Well, the answer is no, he's not lying, because his intention is to benefit these people. And so he's telling them what's suitable for their level of mentality at that particular moment, and his motivation is to benefit. So it's not considered confused speech, it's not considered lies. Yeah, it's considered skillful means. Now, we may say, oh, well, you know, I say what isn't true, that is with a good intention. So isn't that the truth? Well, you know, our good intention usually means it benefits me. So that's not really the good definition of good intention. Yeah. It has to be something that's really a benefit to the other person. Okay, so where are we here? Okay, we'll do another verse. A single shining act of generosity hides the flaws of a king. Likewise, an instance of greed will contradict all of his good qualities. So here, you know, first Nagarjuna spoke about the four qualities to attract disciples. Now he's speaking about another set of four qualities. Okay, so the first one was truth. Yeah, this one's generosity. Then we have tranquility and then wisdom. So another set of four that he's giving the advice to the king to train in these four types of activities. So it's interesting, in the first chapter, you know, he laid out the bare bones of what to practice and what to abandon for higher rebirth. Now he's going into more detail, yeah, especially about what to you know, what to practice and what to abandon. So talking about these pernicious treatises and being able to have wisdom that discriminates, you know, what is a wrong, you know, wrong advice, what is good advice, the four ways of attracting followers, and then this set of four of truth, generosity, tranquility, and what did I say the last one was?
Wisdom.
Duh. Okay, so here we're, a single shining act of generosity hides the flaws of a king. Likewise, an instance of greed will contradict all of his good qualities. So in the same way as, you know, one truth properly told instills trust, and one lie completely demolishes it, yeah? Here, if you're in a leadership position, what he's saying is, as a leader, you may have other faults, but if you're generous, you know, your generosity makes your other faults seem not so big, okay? On the other hand, if we're, you know, as a leader, if you're really greedy and selfish and just thinking about yourself, that even one act of that destroys, you know, again, people's belief in your good qualities. Yeah, so we can see this a lot, can't we? Yeah? Somebody's very generous, we tend to be much more tolerant of their other faults. Yeah, because we see generosity as such a good quality. But then if that person turns around and they're stingy, then we forget about all of their good faults.
Well,
oh yeah, thank you. Just seeing if you're paying attention, even though I'm not. Okay, so we'll find in Precious Garland, again and again, as this text goes on, and we've already had it in chapter one, Nagarjuna is encouraging us to be generous. Yeah, it was one of the three qualities, you know, that was one of the six, of the three qualities to practice, that were that set of 16. Here again, it's coming generosity. When we go on and he gets into the actions that are the causes of the Buddha's physical signs and all sorts of other things. You get generosity there too. So, so Nagarjuna repeatedly speaks about generosity. Chandrakirti also praises generosity in his supplement and specifically says, you know, that so much suffering in the world is due to people not having their requisites, food, clothing, shelter, medicine, because other people are being quite stingy and keeping it or preventing people from having what is rightfully theirs. And I was thinking about this because I was reading about this one, a couple of towns that are quite close to Damascus, but the people in them are starving to death. Yeah, literally starving to death because the, you know, Assad's government is holding the city siege, and Red Cross finally got some food in there a few days ago, but many people have already died of starvation and disease and so on. Yeah, so I mean, you look at that. Is Assad going to have any, you know, viability? Even he wins this war, are people going to trust him as a leader?
He's not going to have anybody to lead. He's killing
them all. Yeah, they're all going to be, they're all refugees or they're all dead. But, you know, so you can see, I mean, it's very easy to see. You look at the advice Nagarjuna is giving and you look at who's practicing it and who's not practicing. You know, I have to say, as long as I'm giving political commentary here, you know, Lee Kuan Yew had his faults, yeah, but he did things that benefited the people. really uplifted the society, didn't he? Because people were very, very poor. And he, you know, they were willing to give up a lot of their freedoms for to have a peaceful society and to have their rice bowl full. And he cared about the people and went about doing that. You know, so I think we have to give him credit for that, despite other things. Yes, you want to comment on it? You want to comment on it? Yeah, I mean, everybody has good qualities and bad qualities, don't they? So, okay. So, also in talking about generosity, Kenzo Rinpoche is saying, if you make it a frequent habit to be generous to a lot of people, then for sure some of the people that you're being generous to are going to be emanations of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And if you are generous to those kind of beings, then they in turn make dedication prayers for your benefit. You know? And then you benefit in that kind of way. Yeah. So I remember just a few days ago I put all those receipts out there on our table for people to look at. They didn't stay out very long. Somebody threw them away after a day or two. But I put out, you remember? Did you look at them? Yeah. So, because when we were in India, we used Abbey money to make donations to quite a number of people and quite a number of monasteries and religious institutions and so on. So I brought back the receipts. You know, the individuals don't always give receipts, but you know, but the institutions do. So I brought that back so that you could see, you know, some of the ways we try to create some virtue for everybody, for the Abbey as an institution and everybody in it. And I think especially, like, we made donations to the Lamrim Organizing Committee and also to the Tashi Lhunpo Organizing Committee. And so these are the people who plan the teachings and who provided tea and lunch and everything for this huge crowd. And so for sure there were going to be some Buddhas and Bodhisattvas among those 30,000 people. Yeah. We may not know exactly who they are, but you know, for sure there's going to be some. And so then you create that karma with them and they make prayers on your behalf. In the same way that, you know, people make offerings to us, and every day the chanting we do off after lunch is we're making prayers for them, aren't we? So there's some kind of karmic link that's going on there whereby the receiver of the donation, you know, dedicates and prays to be able to, you know, help the person making the donation in a Dharma way in a future time. And so Milarepa talked about this, saying that it's kind of like the practitioner and the donor attain enlightenment at the same time. They probably don't do it exactly at the same time, because just being generous isn't accumulating all the causes for enlightenment. But still, you know, like if you benefit somebody who's on the high stages of the path and attains awakening, you know, your donations are, you know, a very important cause of their being able to practice and attain their realizations. And so, of course, they make those prayers and dedications to benefit us. Yeah?
I was thinking about this generosity thing, but it's to be generous to the Triple Gem, mm-hmm. and then to like have regret. You know, sometimes, you know, we're not perfect. And then, so I was thinking, is it better to be generous because of the power of the object? And even though you know that later on you might have that something, whatever, then not to do it because you think your motivation is not pure. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, because by the virtue of the power of the object, regardless if your motivation is big. Later, you might have a bit of, oh my God, I could have done, bought a new bag. But then you did that, and by that, you know, that I personally think, you know, it's better to just do it, because by my own strength, it's very weak, but the power of that object, because it's the triple gem, is the regardless how bad the motivation is, you know.
Yeah.
It's much better than not doing.
Yeah, yeah, it is much better to give, even though you don't have a perfectly pure motivation, to anybody, you know, who's doing it, especially to the Triple Gem, but also to ordinary people or people who are sick or whatever, even you don't have the perfect of perfect motivation. However, if you give and then you regret it, then you destroy your own karma. Okay? So even though you may have, you don't have a completely pure motivation, give, but don't regret it. Yeah? Okay? Because regretting our virtue is the wrong kind of regret. Yeah. But it is good to give whenever we can. And I know I need to nudge myself a lot in that direction. So small, I don't need to help. They're fine without it. I'm too lazy. You know, the thousand and one excuses.
So people who give just for a tax donation to help with their income tax. Mm-hmm.
So people who... People who give just to get a tax donation.
There's maybe some ordinary.
Yeah, by the power of the holy object, there's some virtue. But, you know, the motivation itself isn't virtuous.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
But even then, they're choosing where to give that, and so there is some, you know, it's not just the tax thing. They're like, oh, I can give this to good cause.
Yeah, I mean, if a person's thinking I'm giving it to a good cause and I get a tax donation. But some people might be more interested in the tax donation and just give it anywhere. Yeah, you have to. It's going to be different according to the different people's states of mind. And some people may say, oh, I really want to give and I support this. And it's even better that I get a tax donation, but the tax donation isn't the reason why they're giving. Although, I mean, this is what the government used as a reason to get people to be generous, isn't it? Receiving something from a temple or a monastery, it's good to make a donation and, you know, and compensate for that. Yeah.
The political policy. Thing.
Yeah.
So, as you were teaching, I was really thinking, like, you know, in history, the Buddhist countries, it's not been really successful in politically wise. And it's not sustainable as well. Like even the great Ashoka, King Ashoka, kind of never really, it didn't like go on, it wasn't able to sustain.
I mean after Ashoka died.
Yeah, and then like the leader could be very virtuous, whereas the people below
moment.
It's very, very, very difficult to move so many, many people with different agendas. Mm-hmm. And is this an ideal? How realistic is this?
Yeah, this is an ideal, but even though, it's difficult to move a whole group of people, all of whom have different agendas, like you say, still, the leader being virtuous is going to help that happen much quicker than the leader being non-virtuous. Isn't it? Yeah. So whenever you're talking about a huge group of people to get people on board and make change, it's difficult. But if you have a leader that people trust, it's going to be easier than a leader that people don't trust. And if you look at the Buddhist countries and say, well, none of them become very rich or whatever, physical, monetary wealth isn't necessarily the measure of real happiness. And if you look at this country, it's the wealthiest country, and people have less physical problems, but incredible mental problems in this country. And actually, there's quite a bit of poverty in this country as well, too, that people ignore and overlook. So I think when Kensrumche was saying, always acting with truth and always acting with integrity, things may not go so well now, but in the long run, they will. And anyway, if you don't act with integrity and you act with dishonesty and corruption, then are things going to go well or not? No. I mean, you may wind up with some monetary success, but then again, especially if you're corrupt, the people who follow you are going to be corrupt too. And then how long is that, empire going to be able to sustain itself? So just because things aren't perfect doesn't mean we don't try to be virtuous. We try and we do our best. Why things don't become perfect? Why? Because there's a lot of other factors, another karma, another conditions ripening. But definitely if we, are lying and deceptive and cheating people, then things for sure aren't going to go well. I mean, you may get some extra added money at the beginning, but then what happens when? Then you become another one of these people who gets written about on the front page, who did the same thing that all the other people did, but thought that somehow they weren't going to get caught. You become like one of them. Yeah. So, I think better things to do than that.
I think that's where it's very helpful to have a long-term view of being, let's say, a virtuous leader, to have a long-term view that no matter how few of those that follow you are able to create the causes for virtue in their minds for the long-term goal, the ripening of beings' minds in the order of virtue will repay itself a millionfold, but it would require having a much bigger view of just the happiness of this life to really do it without being discouraged and without having expectations that are unrealistic.
Right, yeah. As a leader, if you expect all your followers to be virtuous, like fat chance, but still you're influencing people in a positive way and things are definitely going to go better than if you didn't act that way. Okay, so we completed 136, we're on 137, right? Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Guru Anamandala Kandiryatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of explaining
and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising,